Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and I am delighted to be joined by Moussa Alghabi. Moussa, you're the author of a brilliant book, We Have Never Been Woke, probably one of the best timed books in history. It came out just before the US presidential election, and, you know, everyone would probably describe it as prescient. The way you describe it is that we're in the middle of we're at the tail end of a fourth great awakening. What were the other awakenings?
Sure. Yeah. So an awakening is a period of rapid change in how people talk and think about social justice, how they engage in political activity and so on. What I show in the book is that you can actually measure these changes in kind of concrete empirical ways using a whole bunch of sociological tools. And when you do this, yeah, you can see that this kind of shifting we saw after 2010 is a case of something. And so the previous ones, you know what's funny, I'll just say, we actually have a colloquial language for talking about these different periods of awakening. Like we talk about different waves of feminism or different waves of anti-racism. They actually correspond to the same, when you look at the empirical indicators, they actually track pretty closely with what we talk about as different waves of feminism and so on. So for instance, the first great awakening was in the 20s through the 30s. The second was in the mid-60s to the early 70s. The third was in the late 80s to the early 90s. That was the last time we had these blow-ups around what they called then political correctness, but today we call wokeness. And then we had the most recent one starting after 2010.
And what are some of those empirical indicators? Because obviously the way we talk about it is the vibe shift, something that you just sort of feel in the ether. What are the actual concrete data that you're able to point to?
Yeah, so for instance, a colleague, David Rosato, and I, we analyzed, we used machine learning tools, I should say, to analyze 27 million news articles from 47 media outlets over the past 50 years. And we saw that there was this kind of rapid spike in talking about all forms of prejudice and discrimination, racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia. It's just all at once, corresponding to anything that seemed to be happening in the world. And in fact, we did statistical tests that seemed to suggest that most of the change we saw was driven by one single deeper underlying shift. So like something changed about the people who produced the news and that changed the outputs. And you can see the same kinds of shifts that we saw in the media. You can see the same kinds of shifts in academic research papers, in books, in pop culture outlets, like in movies and video games and things like this. You can see shifts in the themes and in the subject matters. You can see shifts in protest activity, specifically in urban centers that have strong knowledge economy hubs. You can see shifts in political alignments and how especially the people who are associated with the knowledge professions underwent a lot of shifts in the parties that they identify with, how they self-identify ideologically, like liberal, conservative, and so on. And then finally, how they answer poll and survey questions about things like if immigration should be increased or decreased, how big of a problem is racism in America. You can see, looking at poll and survey data, you can also see these kinds of rapid shifts in attitudes.
And you mentioned the sort of knowledge economy. That's where this is centered. That's where this is all happening, wokeness is happening.
Yeah, so the big changes you see, they're not society-wide. It's actually a very specific subset of people, people who are highly educated, who are relatively affluent, who are urban and suburban, especially white people. So the people who are the same slice of society that dominates the knowledge professions. So this is the group that shifted. And then also when you look at institutional policy shifts and protest activity and so on, the shifts are usually in institutions that are associated with the knowledge economy in terms of policy changes with DEI and stuff like this, most aggressive in these kinds of institutions. And again, changes in protest activity also in these kinds of towns.
And what are the kind of structural things that lead to these awakenings? What's going on in the background that is spurring what are really pretty affluent people into feeling dissatisfied or into agitating around various political issues?
Yeah, so the nice thing about measuring things and taking a longer view is that I was able to ask this question. So if this is a case of something and there are a bunch of awakenings, we can compare them and we can contrast them. And we can ask ourselves, like, why do they happen? Why don't they go on forever? Like, why do they end? Do they change anything? And so on. And so as far as why do they happen, I identified two factors that seem to be the most, that seem to predict awakenings. The first is that they tend to happen when there's some kind of a crisis for knowledge economy professionals, usually, most especially, elite overproduction. So elite overproduction is a situation where you have, growing numbers of people who have a reasonable expectation to be elites, but society just can't give them the kind of lives that they were looking for. So they did everything right. You know, they went to school, they went to the right schools, they majored in the right things, they got good grades, and they were expecting a six-figure salary and a stable job and to be able to get married and this kind of stuff. And then it turns out that, you know, it's just not in the cards for them, or it doesn't seem to be. When you have growing numbers of aspiring elites who find themselves in that position, what they often tend to do is indict the social order that they think failed them, and try to tear down some of the successful elites to make room for people like themselves, and also tear down their competitors. And I argue like this is primarily what's happening during these awakenings. But elite overproduction isn't sufficient to explain awakenings, in part because of this other thing that we see in when we look at social science data, which is that the fates of elites and non-elites tend to operate countercyclically. So often when times are kind of bad for elites, they're just fine for everyone else. And so if elites are in this situation where they're having a tough time, but everyone else is doing fine, then no one really cares about their struggles. Like, no one's breaking out their violin like, oh, poor elite, you have to get a normal job and live a normal life like everyone else. Oh my gosh. They don't care. But there are some times when these trajectories get collapsed, when things have been kind of growing bad and worse for ordinary people for a while, and all of a sudden they're bad for elites too. And so when you have those moments of confluence, that's when awakenings happen, because you have these frustrated elites, but they have more leverage over the system than they ordinarily would, because there's all these other people in society who also have a bone to pick. But the people who have been calling the shots were also really dissatisfied with the way things have been going. And so that gives these frustrated elites a lot more leverage over the system than they would normally have.
And certainly with the case with wokeness, it's not as if people are making claims about themselves or talking about, they wouldn't say directly that I deserve to have XYZ position or XYZ power. They say they're speaking on behalf of racial minorities. Yeah. Or other sort of minority groups. How do you explain that and account for that? Is it just a sort of, a status signaling thing? Is it a way of disguising real interests? How do you explain it?
The people who work in the knowledge fields just have, really interesting jobs, in the sense that, when you look at the creation of a lot of these fields, like, law, psychology, and like these journalism, these kinds of knowledge professions, when you look at the beginning of the fields, when they first got created as professions in a recognizably modern form, one of the things you see is that, you know, compared to most other workers, people who work in these professions, we get paid a lot more than most people. We have a lot more autonomy in terms of how we structure our time and what we do and so on. We have a lot more social prestige. And from the beginning of our professions, we've said the reason you should give us these things, it's not for our own sake. No, never for us. But because if you give us these things, if you give us this autonomy, this pay, and so on, it will better empower us to help everyone in society, including and especially the least among us, the marginalized and the disadvantaged. And so from the beginning of our profession, our bids for power and status and resources and opportunity were just bound up with these claims about doing social good and especially helping the least advantaged. And so this gives... this created a unique form of status competition in our professions, where for 100 years now it's been the case that people who are especially effective at presenting themselves as allies for the marginalized and the disadvantaged are seen especially worthy of power and status and opportunity, and people who are successfully painted as having the wrong motives or being in bed with the wrong people and so on are seen as especially unworthy of jobs and power and status, and can find their position fragile. And this has been the case for 100 years. And so when these moments of popular immiseration happen, these are real moments of opportunity for us. Because again, if our bids for power and status are built up with helping the marginalized and the disadvantaged, we can point to a lot of normie people in society and say, look, they're suffering.
Yeah.
You're doing a bad job. We need more power and resources in order to fix this problem, right? Like, so the, that's one of the reasons why this confluence is. And the last thing I'll say about this, it is the case that in these periods, we're trying to advance our interests and further our goals. You can see this very clearly. I lay it out clearly in the book. But one thing that's important for me to underline, that I do underline in the book, is that it's not the case that knowledge economy professionals are being cynical or insincere, though.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, for instance, when we say we want the poor to be uplifted, we want the people in the margins of society to live lives of dignity and inclusion, we're not lying. When people were crying after George Floyd was murdered, like, that was a performance, but it wasn't just a performance. They were actually sad.
Yeah.
What I argue in the book is not that symbolic capitalists, these knowledge economy professionals, it's not that we're cynical or insincere. The problem is that our social justice commitments are one set of sincere commitments.
Mm.
We also have this other set of equally sincere commitments that is kind of intention with that. Namely, we want to be elites.
Yeah.
So the people who work in the knowledge professions, we think that our perspective should count more than the people checking us out at the grocery store. We should carry more weight. And we think we should have a higher standard of living than the people delivering our packages or driving us around. And we want our children to reproduce our own social position or to do even better than us and so on. And these two drives, the drive to be an egalitarian and the drive to be an elite, they're in fundamental tension. You can't actually be an egalitarian social climber. It's a contradiction in terms, right? And so what I argue is that when these two sets of sincere commitments come into conflict, as they often do, it's often our desire to be an elite that ends up winning out and kind of transforming how we pursue these social justice goals. So we end up pursuing them mostly in ways that don't cost anything for us, risk anything for us, require us to change anything about our own lives and lifestyles and aspirations and so on. Mostly we kind of hope that we can achieve these goals by just, if we can just take things from other people in the right way. Yeah.
So what do you think comes next? I mean, we're talking about the vibe shift. There's even talk about a woke right, you know, similar dynamics, but being reproduced in a different way with a different underlying politics. What is your sense of the current moment and where things are going?
Yeah, so one of the things that you see when you compare the awakenings is one thing that doesn't happen in these periods of awakenings. What you don't see is significant changes that favor the genuinely marginalized and disadvantaged in society. You don't see a massive transfer of wealth and opportunities and stuff downwards. That never happens, didn't happen in this period of time, didn't happen in any of the previous ones during these periods of awakenings. These awakenings are often met with backlash. We often describe that backlash as people being upset about all the gains that were made for women and minorities and so on.
Yeah.
But actually, when you look, there were basically no gains that happened during these periods. So the backlash is not that. The reason why you see backlash across all of these episodes is that even in normal times, the people who work in fields like journalism and academia, we tend to like think about politics and participate in politics in ways that are just very different from normal people. During these periods of awakening, those gaps grow bigger because we change a lot.
Yeah.
Most of the rest of society stays on the same trajectory they were on. And not only do the gaps go bigger, but people care about them more, mostly because of how we conduct ourselves. So we become very militant about mocking and censoring and deriding and coercing people who disagree with us, sometimes about views that we ourselves just adopted 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And people notice this. And this creates a opportunity for right-aligned political actors, usually, to campaign on bringing institutions like ours under control. So these kinds of narratives about how the media has become a propaganda arm for liberal parties and universities have become indoctrination machines, these kinds of narratives become popular after each of the awakenings, and they become popular in part because they actually are cued onto realities at that time. So during those periods, it actually is the case that, for instance, academics are become more oriented in trying to push political beliefs, and journalists become more activist oriented during these periods. That's not a that's not misinformation. It's the thing that's actually happening that people pick up on. But what you usually see in the aftermath of the awakenings is kind of durably reduced trust in mainstream institutions that kind of persists for a while. You see usually gains for right-aligned political actors in the short to medium term, but those also burn out for reasons that I could talk about. You see the creation of alternative infrastructures of knowledge production. So, like, for instance, in the last awakening, there was this sense that the media was lost. You can't fix it. So a lot of right-aligned people launched right-aligned media outlets like Fox News that just eat everyone's lunch on the cable media news outlet. And then more recently, you see these moves by Elon Musk, for instance, to acquire Twitter, or Peter Thiel to acquire Rumble. And so you see this creation of alternative infrastructures of trying to communicate with the people and produce knowledge and so on. That's usually one of the big legacies of the awakenings.
Wait, so Darby, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.